Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an Associate Director with the Federal Society's Practice Groups. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Today's Courthouse Steps program will be a discussion of yesterday's 6-3 decision in Louisiana v. Calais, with the court's opinion written by Justice Samuel Alito. Joining us to discuss this monumental decision, we have Mr. Bradley Benbrook, Managing Partner at the Benbrook Law Group, and Professor Mike Domino of Widener University Commonwealth Law School, who coincidentally just published a new book, Understanding Election Law, and has an upcoming case law book, Voting Rights and Election Law. If our audience has any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen and not the chat, so we'll be able to access them later on. With that note, I will turn things over to our speakers to start today's conversation. Brad, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Libby. It's my great pleasure to be here with Professor Domino to talk about Calais. Mike, when we did our Courthouse Steps program on this case 6 months ago, we said it could be a blockbuster and it didn't disappoint. I'd like to start by setting up the landscape for our listeners who aren't election law nerds. Calais is important because it resolved a question that the Supreme Court had avoided for 30 years. The problem traces back to the compromise of the 1982 amendments to the Voting Rights Act and the Major Jingles decision from 1986 that set out the test for proving a Section 2 violation when it comes to drawing district lines. And the problem over the years would play out as follows. After each census since at least 1990, when it came time to redistrict, states would say, okay, we have to create some number of majority-minority districts in order to avoid a claim that we are violating Section 2. And on the one hand, even after creating these set-aside districts, the VRA, litigation industrial complex, would say, that's not enough. You have to draw more majority-minority districts. And as computer models became more sophisticated, it became easier to create all kinds of different districts for whatever reasons, including race. On the other hand, opponents would say these race-based districts that are being drawn are racial gerrymanders. You are considering race in drawing district lines without any finding that the state discriminated on race. So that violates the 14th Amendment. And this dynamic set up what has been referred to as the tension between the Voting Rights Act and the 14th Amendment. And the Supreme Court had avoided that question over and over by saying, we're going to assume for the sake of deciding this case that compliance with the Voting Rights Act is a compelling interest that justifies considering race in drawing district lines. Yet sometimes it would also basically say, but don't be blatant about it. Don't draw districts that string together minority communities that are really far apart. And if you go overboard, you violate the 14th Amendment. Needless to say, this state of the law didn't result in much clarity, and the litigation continued, which brings us to Calais. Calais demonstrated how out of control Section 2 litigation had become. Until the 2020 reapportionment, Louisiana had always had 7 congressional seats and never had more than 1 majority-minority districts. And keep in mind, Louisiana had to get its districts pre-cleared by the Department of Justice in 1980, 1990, 2000. And the Clinton and Obama Department of Justice never said, hey, you're violating the Voting Rights Act by having only 1 majority-minority district. Yet, in 2025, with only 6 seats now instead of 7, a district court in Louisiana said Section 2 required that Louisiana, for the first time, must have 2 majority-minority districts. How can this possibly be? How can it possibly make sense 60 years after the Voting Rights Act was passed? So Justice Alito says in the opening paragraph of Calais, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act was designed to enforce the Constitution, not collide with it. Unfortunately, lower courts have sometimes applied this court's Section 2 precedents in a way that forces states to engage in the very race-based discrimination that the Constitution forbids. As a result, he said, compliance with Section 2 as properly construed, which he emphasized, can justify race-based districting, but correctly understood, he said, Section 2 does not impose liability at odds with the Constitution, and it should not have imposed liability on Louisiana for failing to have a second majority-minority district here. So, Mike, can you summarize, please, for our listeners, how Justice Alito explained there was no tension as to Section 2 when it is properly construed?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks to you and the Federalist Society for hosting this and for having me here. I agree with you that Calais is a tremendously important decision, mostly because of the way that Justice Alito reinterprets Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Now, for those of you who are not terribly familiar with the act as a whole, remember that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act applied only to covered jurisdictions, particular areas with a history of discrimination, mostly in the South. But Section 2, the part of the Voting Rights Act that was at issue in this case, applied nationwide. And so the redistricting rules that were imposed on the country by Section 2 applied to every jurisdiction, whether or not there was a history of racial discrimination in voting. I think it's fair to say the prevailing interpretation of Section 2 prior to this case was that the Voting Rights Act created what amounted to an entitlement to rough proportionality in districting for minority groups. That is, that minority groups would be entitled under the VRA to to control over a number of legislative seats proportionate to the minority group's share of the population. So in Louisiana, if Black voters were roughly one sixth of the population, then they would be presumptively entitled to one-sixth of the legislative seats. But if they had closer to two-sixths of the population in Louisiana, which was closer to the numbers that are actually true, that they would presumptively be entitled to two of those six legislative seats, so long as a district that the court said was reasonably compact could be drawn such as to give the minority group control over that number of seats. That is, you're creating a sufficient number of majority-minority districts so that the minority group had a roughly proportional control over the district.
And I would interject, this rough understanding applied, notwithstanding that the text of the Section 2 expressly says nothing in here entitles minority groups to proportionate representation.
That's right. It was a quite remarkable interpretation of the act. And even the court in this case says, well, you know, Jingles, which interpreted the statute in this kind of curious way, dates from the era when we didn't really do statutory interpretation the right way. We didn't pay enough attention to statutory language. We kind of cited legislative history and then did whatever we wanted. It's a pretty overt reference to the kind of bad old days of statutory interpretation. The lead opinion in Jingles, as one might suspect, is written by Justice Brennan, who interpreted Section 2 very broadly. So I'd like to describe his interpretation a bit and then talk about how Justice Alito reinterprets Section 2 in a way that significantly departs from the understanding of Justice Brennan's plurality opinion in that case. What Justice Brennan said is that a minority group who is seeking to raise a Section 2 challenge should have to satisfy four things. So the three, what Brennan called preconditions, three preconditions, and then a totality of the circumstances test. So condition number one, precondition number one, was that the minority group has to be sufficiently large and geographically compact to be able to constitute a majority in a single member district. So if you're not large enough, if you're spread out too much so that we can't draw a majority-minority district, then the state's failure to draw one doesn't violate the Voting Rights Act. Precondition number two was that the minority group must show that it is politically cohesive, that it has preferred candidates, that the minority group members have sufficiently similar political preferences, that the group as a whole has preferred candidates. The third condition was that the white majority, referred to as the white majority, must vote sufficiently as a block to be able to defeat the minority group's preferred candidate. And then in the minority group must also show that when you consider the totality of the circumstances, that minority groups must be deprived of an equal opportunity to participate in the political process, and in particular to elect representatives of their choice. What this amounted to in practice was that if the minority group was big enough so that the share of the population was enough to correspond to at least one of the legislative districts that were being created, that the minority group would basically be entitled to a proportionate share of legislative seats. The totality of the circumstances test at the end basically meant, although the court never quite said this, it basically meant that that if the minority group was being denied roughly proportional representation, that that amounted to a denial of an equal opportunity to elect representatives of the group's choice. So what Justice Alito says is that Section 2 does not create and was not supposed to create, in fact, as you pointed out, explicitly says it is not creating a right to proportional representation. So even though that's the way the court interpretations seem to have gone, that's not what the statute says. That's not what the statute originally meant. And so the bottom line of this case is that we return the understanding of Section 2 of the Act to an understanding pretty close to what it says and what it should have meant for close to the last 45 years. So how does Alito do this? In the first place, he says, let's consider Jingles' part one, this idea that the minority group has to be sufficiently large and geographically compact to constitute a majority in a single member district. The way that plaintiffs have proven this in Section 2 litigation is to submit illustrative maps as alternatives to the state's plan. Said, you shouldn't have drawn the map that you did. You should instead have drawn a map like this one that we're offering to the court that creates additional majority-minority districts. What Justice Alito said is that when you're creating those illustrative maps, you can't use race as a criterion in drawing them. That is, you can't put into the computer, give us a plan that produces two or three majority-minority districts. Instead, Justice Alito says, it's not a Section 2 violation for the government to draw districts that don't privilege race. So if you draw a set of districts and you can come up with those lines only by privileging race, you're not proving that the state violated the Constitution or violated Section 2 when it didn't draw the same districts that you wanted drawn. And the second thing that Alito says about this, this sufficiently large and geographically compact prong of the Jingles requirement is that he says, when you create these illustrative maps and you don't consider race in creating them, you must ensure that the illustrative map satisfies all of the government's other criteria. So if the government wants to draw districts that basically retain the shape of the prior districts, or that protect incumbents, or that protect the party in power. The illustrative maps have to achieve those interests as well. This is hugely important because what often drives this litigation, like what often drives everything else in politics, is partisanship. So you'll have a Republican legislature that'll draw districts so as to get the reelection of Republicans. And you'll have Democrats who come in and use the Voting Rights Act and say, well, you got to draw a district that's going to be controlled by minority groups who are going to vote Democratic. And so you're going to create these extra majority minority districts. But really what the Democratic side cares about is you're going to undermine the Republican majority. You're going to reduce the number of seats controlled by Republicans. You're going to increase the number of seats controlled by Democrats. So Justice Alito says, if you got a Republican gerrymander that's drawn for political purposes rather than racial purposes, the illustrative maps have to say you need to create extra majority minority districts that also result in the election of the same number of Republicans. So that's hugely important. It makes it really, really difficult to succeed on a Section 2 claim. But Justice Alito wasn't done. The court wasn't done. I say Justice Alito, but he's speaking for a six-justice majority. This isn't a plurality opinion like in past cases, not split at all. We have a solid six-justice majority for all of these conclusions. So the next thing that the court does is that it says, well, you have to compare the preferences of the minority group to the preferences of the majority. Because obviously, if the majority and the minority prefer the same candidates, well, then you're not harming anybody's ability to elect candidates, no matter how you draw the districts, because you all prefer the same candidates and those candidates are going to win. In the past, at least what some people have interpreted the Voting Rights Act to mean is that if minority groups prefer Democrats and the majority prefers Republicans, then automatically you satisfy this criterion of racially polarized voting. The minority group votes sufficiently as a block to say, well, we have a preference and it's whoever the Democrats nominate. And the white majority has an alternative preference for the Republican candidate. And if the majority is more numerous, because it's after all the majority, then it's likely to be able to result in the defeat of the minority preferred candidate. So this prior interpretation had basically said, if you're in a jurisdiction where minorities prefer Democrats like they usually do and whites prefer Republicans like they often do, then you automatically have racially polarized voting. Justice Alito says, no, that's not what it means. That you, when you figure out racially polarized voting, when you're trying to figure out whether the minority group has political preferences and whether the white majority has political preferences, you must control for party preferences. So if the whites vote for Republicans and the minorities vote for Democrats, then favoring the Republican candidate is not racial discrimination, and it's not a violation of Section 2. It's political rather than racial. And instead, what you have to show is that the whites refuse to vote for candidates who are minority regardless of party. And same thing with the minority group. But that's going to be a very hard show.
Jump in right there on the concept of disentangling race. You have to give credit to Justice Alito's fearlessness. He points out the whole reason the VRA was enacted is that back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, white Democrats refused to vote for Black Democrats. And so he just laid it out right there. That was the way the world was back then. But and that's why there was a need for this sort of protection. But the world has changed. It's not like that anymore.
That's right. Yeah, he points out to exactly that fact. You're absolutely correct. And in in 1982, and certainly, as you say, before that point, you can speak of racial discrimination within voting as distinct from politics. And of course, to some extent, you still can. But to the extent that politics has overtaken race, Justice Alito says, we have moved beyond the concerns that Section 2 was put in place to address. And then, so far, I've considered the three preconditions from Jingles and the way that Justice Alito's majority opinion addresses those or reformulates them. The totality of the circumstances test is changed by this opinion, too, and again, in a significant way, that it is no longer the case, to the extent it ever was, it's no longer the case that you can demonstrate a totality of the circumstances showing that minority groups lack an equal opportunity to elect legislators of their choice simply by pointing to a disparity between their share of the population and their share of control over legislative seats. That is, mere disproportionate representation of racial groups is not an unequal opportunity to elect representatives of your choice. Instead, Justice Alito says, well, what Section 2 means by that is that we need to focus on circumstances that show a substantial likelihood of intentional discrimination in voting. That is, you don't have to prove what was in the mind of legislators. It's not purely an intent test. Court says we are still focused on results, but the results have to be more than simply disproportionate control of legislative seats. Instead, you have to go back to pre-1982 cases that the Supreme Court decided interpreting the constitutional protection against voting discrimination, where the court said that what violates the Constitution is a combination of electoral rules, cultural conditions, and other kinds of laws that have the effect as a whole of blocking minorities from participating in the political process and translating their preferences into political results. And if you don't have that, because if you do have it, then it indicates a kind of a likelihood of intentional discrimination. But if you don't have it, all you have is a disproportionate result. That's not the kind of thing that Section 2 interferes with.
Right. And getting back to resolving the tension, he says you need to be able to show that all of these circumstances combine to create a strong inference of intentional discrimination when it comes to this districting plan, which in modern day times is going to be extremely difficult to show, because it's a very different world than it was 50, 60 years ago. And that's a theme that he picked up on that's very consistent with some of the several cases of the Chief Justice Roberts Court that basically says, hey, let's look at reality. We live in a very different country than we did back then. As one example, we did an amicus brief in this case for Center for Election Confidence. And one issue we stressed was that Jingles requires intense racial segregation to work at its first step. But the country, including the South, is much more integrated. And Section 2 litigators and sort of lefty election law professors write that, this is a problem for our Voting Rights Act cases, that we're so much more integrated. And we say, this should be celebrated. And Justice Alito agrees. He wrote, if as a result of this progress, it is hard to find pertinent evidence relating to intentional present day voting discrimination, that is cause for celebration. And that's one of my favorite lines of the case. So, Micah, one other thing that stood out to me is that Justice Alito cited the SFFA versus Harvard case multiple times. And although he didn't really put it in these terms, the concept of safe Black or Hispanic districts are essentially quotas or affirmative action for politicians. And the upshot is that this should be no different. He also said, and he quoted SFFA to say, there are extremely limited circumstances where this court has ever allowed the consideration of race. And the only two really have been avoiding race riots in prison and where there's an actual finding of discrimination in violation of a statute or the Constitution. And he said this added to the list, but it really is kind of an extension of part two. In that extremely short list. But on the Harvard case, I do want to say a shout out to our friend Edward Bloom for all of his work, not just in the Harvard case, but for his work in the Voting Rights Act starting many years ago. So, Mike, in terms of what does this mean? Most immediately, it's expected, you know, that some red states will now look at their maps and say there was no race discrimination that justified setting aside these two or three or however many majority minority districts. So we're going to reevaluate and get rid of them. Doesn't the Texas litigation and now Calais show the Supreme Court is likely not going to stand in the way of that?
I think that's true. I think that the major practical effect of this case is that it's going to free Republican-controlled states to draw district lines without worrying that they're going to get sued under Section 2 if they don't create a certain number of majority-minority districts. Now, this doesn't totally get rid of Section 2. It does allow certainly for the possibility of a lawsuit where there either is intentional discrimination or there are circumstances that give rise to a significant influence. For example, if you have take an example that Justice Kagan gives in her dissent, if you have a solidly minority city that would be a district and the government decides to carve it up so as to deprive the minority group of voting influence, then it's possible that that would still be considered a Section 2 violation. Of course, the government then would try to divide it to defend on the ground by saying that we're dividing up that group not because of race, but because of partisanship. And so you still have a kind of fight about it. But the case at least still allows for the possibility of that kind of suit. But I think you're absolutely right that even if it's too late to do it now, before the midterms are only 6 months away. Most of the districts in most of the states are pretty well set. But I think that before the next elections and certainly immediately after the 2030 census, you're going to have a lot of Republican states that are going to draw more heavily Republican favored district lines because they don't have to worry as much about a Section 2 suit.
So, one more shout out. I would like to congratulate our fellow executive committee member on the election law group, Eddie Grime, who represented the Calais plaintiffs on this case. So congratulations to Eddie. And Mike, if you don't have any more points that you want to talk about, perhaps we could look at some of the questions, Libby, that have come up.
Absolutely. We've got two down here. One's on Section 2 about if the majority opinion requires proof of discriminatory intent, and if so, how does that square with Section 2's focus on a discriminatory result?
Yeah, as a formal matter, it does not require discriminatory intent. But as we mentioned, the court does require circumstances that give rise to an inference of discriminatory intent. So it certainly cuts back on the understanding that had prevailed up until this point, that all that mattered was results, and the only result that mattered was a disproportion in the legislative seats that were controlled.
Great. And then Brad, I don't know if you want to add anything there, but it sounds like you guys covered that pretty well. Yeah. As well. And then We have another one on asking for further examples of fact situations where Section 2 would still support a claim.
Well, I'll let Mike chime in. I think the one he already posed is the most likely place where you could have these sort of claim where, for example, a big city like Atlanta, Houston, New Orleans, where a Republican state legislature would perhaps get overzealous and start carving up slices out into the suburbs and beyond. The old expression is cracking the district. I think that is one area where you would have litigation. Mike, I'll turn it over to you for other examples.
Yeah, let me give you one more possibility. I don't think that there's going to be too many of these, but if you have a significant divide within the Democratic Party between the candidates who are preferred by minority voters and the candidates who are preferred by white Democrats, if the white Democrats are in control and draw district lines in such a way as to harm the interests of the candidates who are preferred by the minorities, that could still give rise to a claim. So it's the court in this case says we're not going to consider it racial discrimination if we can explain the differences in preferences just by pointing to party. But if you're within a single party and minority groups have different preferences, then I think Section 2 still has a role to play.
All right, Libby, we almost made it in 30 minutes. So
well done. I'm very impressed. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today, for sharing your expertise and opinions on this really important decision. For audiences interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org. Or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.